Mark well what you have witnessed here, people of Bryn Shander, Cassel sneered. Bow to your master, or the same fate shall befall you. And there is no water behind you. You have nowhere to run. He laughed wildly again and looked all about the city's hill, as though he was searching for something. What are you to do? He cackled. You have no lake. I have spoken, Cassius. Hear me well. You will deliver an emissary unto me tomorrow, an emissary to bear the news of your unconditional surrender. And if your pride prevents such an act, remember the cries of dying Targos. Look to the city on the banks of Mare de Walden for guidance, pitiful Cassius. The fire shall not have died when the morrow dawns. Just then, a courier raced up to the spokesman. Many ships have been spotted moving out from under the blanket of smoke in Targos. Newsbearer signals have already begun coming in from the refugees. And what of Kemp? Cassius asked anxiously. He lives, the courier answered, and he has vowed revenge. Cassius breathed a sigh of relief. He wasn't overly fond of his peer from Targos, but he knew that the battle-seasoned spokesman would prove a valuable asset to Ten Town's cause before all was through. Kessel heard the conversation and growled in disdain. "And where shall they run?" he asked Cassius. The spokesman, intent on studying this unpredictable and unbalanced adversary, did not reply, but Kessel answered the question for him. "To Bremen? But they cannot!" He snapped his fingers, beginning the chain of a prearranged message to his westernmost forces. At once, a large group of goblins broke rank and started out to the west, toward Bremen. You see? Bremen falls before the night is through, and yet another fleet will scurry out onto their precious lake. The scene shall be repeated in the town in the wood with predictable results. But what protection will the lakes offer these people when the merciless winter begins to fall? He shouted. How fast shall their ships sail away from me when the waters are frozen around them? He laughed again, but this time more seriously, more dangerously. What protection do any of you have against Akar Kessel? Cassius and the wizard held each other in unyielding glares. The wizard barely mouthed the words, but Cassius heard him clearly. What protection? Out on Mare de Walden, Kemp bit back his frustrated rage as he watched his city tumble in flames. Soot-blackened faces stared back to the burning ruins in horrified disbelief, shouting impossible denials and openly crying for their lost friends and kin. But like Cassius, Kemp converted his despair into constructive anger. As soon as he learned of the goblin force departing for Bremen, he dispatched his fastest ship to warn the people of that distant city and to inform them of the happenings across the lake. Then he sent a second ship toward Lonelywood to beg for food and bandages, and perhaps an invitation to dock. Despite their obvious differences, the spokesmen of the Ten Towns were in many ways alike. Like a Gorwell, who had been happy to sacrifice everything for the good of the people, and Jensen Brent, who refused to yield to despair. Kemp of Targos set about rallying his people for a retaliatory strike. He didn't yet know how he would accomplish the feat, but he knew that he had not had his final say in the wizard's war. And poised upon the wall of Bryn Shander, Cassius knew it too. 25. Air 2. Drizzt crawled out of his hidden chamber as the last lights of the setting sun began fading away. He scanned the southern horizon and was again dismayed. He had needed to rest, but he couldn't help feeling pangs of guilt when he saw the city of Targos burning, as though he had neglected his duty to bear witness to the suffering of Kessel's helpless victims. Yet the drow had not been idle, even during the hours of the meditative trance the elves called sleep. He had journeyed back into the underworld of his distant memories in search of a particular sensation, the aura of a powerful presence he had once known. Though he had not gotten close enough for a good look at the demon he had followed the previous night, something about the creature had struck a familiar chord in his oldest recollections. A pervading, unnatural emanation surrounded creatures from the lower planes when they walked on the material world, an aura that the Dark Elves, more so than any other race, had come to understand and recognize. Not only this type of demon, but this particular creature itself was known to Drizzt. It had served his people in Menzo Baranzon for many years. "Ertu," he whispered, as he sorted through his dreams. Drizzt knew the demon's true name. It would come to his call. The search to find an appropriate spot from which he could call the demon took Drizzt over an hour, and he spent several more preparing the area. His goal was to take away as many of Ertu's advantages, size and flight in particular, as he could, though he sincerely hoped that their meeting would not involve combat. People who knew the drow considered him daring, sometimes even reckless, but that was against mortal enemies who would recoil from the stinging pain of his whirring blades. Demons, especially one of Ertu's size and strength, were a different story altogether. Many times during his youth, Drizzt had witnessed the wrath of such a monster. He had seen buildings thrown down, solid stone torn by the great clawed hands. He had seen mighty human warriors strike the monster with blows that would fell an ogre, only to find in their dying horror that their weapons were useless against such a powerful being from the lower planes. His own people usually fared better against demons, actually receiving a measure of respect from them. Demons often allied with drow on even terms, or even served the Dark Elves outright, for they were wary of the powerful weapons and magic the drow possessed. But that was back in the underworld, where the strange emanations from the unique stone formations blessed the metals used by the drow craftsmen with mysterious and magical properties. Drizzt had none of the weapons from his homeland, for their strange magic could not withstand the light of day. Though he had been careful to keep them protected from the sun, they became useless shortly after he moved to the surface. He doubted that the weapons he now carried would be able to harm Ertu at all. And even if they did, demons of Ertu's stature could not be truly destroyed away from their native planes. If it came to blows, the most that Drizzt could hope to do was banish the creature from the material plane for 100 years. He had no intentions of fighting. Yet he had to try something against the wizard who threatened the towns. His goal now was to gain some knowledge that might reveal a weakness in the wizard, and his method was deception and disguise, hoping that Ertu remembered enough about the Dark Elves to make his story credible, yet not too much to strip away the flimsy lies that would hold it together. The place he had chosen for the meeting was a sheltered dell a few yards from the mountain's cliff face. A pinnacled roof formed by converging walls covered half of the area. The other half was open to the sky, but the entire place was set back into the mountainside behind high walls, safely out of view of Kryshal Tirith. Now Drizzt worked with a dagger, scraping runes of warding on the walls and floor in front of where he would sit. His mental image of these magical symbols had fuzzied over the many years, and he knew that their design was far from perfect. Yet he realized that he would need any possible protection that they might offer if Ertu turned on him. When he was finished, he sat cross-legged under the roofed section, behind the protected area, and tossed out the small statuette that he carried in his pack. Guinevar would be a good test for his warding inscriptions. The great cat answered the summons. It appeared in the other side of the cubby, its keen eyes scanning the area for any potential danger that threatened its master. Then, sensing nothing, it turned a curious glance on Drizzt. "Come to me," Drizzt called, beckoning with his hand. The cat strode toward him, then stopped abruptly, as though it had walked into a wall. Drizzt sighed in relief when he saw that his runes held some measure of strength. His confidence was bolstered considerably, though he realized that Ertu would push the power of the runes to their absolute limits and probably beyond. Guinevar lolled its huge head in an effort to understand what had deterred it. The resistance hadn't really been very strong, but the mixed signals from its master, calling for it yet warding it away, had confused the cat. It considered gathering its strength and walking right through the feeble barrier, but its master seemed pleased that it had stopped. So the cat sat where it was and waited. Drizzt was busy studying the area, searching out the optimum place for Guinevere to spring from and surprise the demon. A deep ledge on one of the high walls, just beyond the portion that converged into a roof, seemed to offer the best concealment. He motioned the cat into position and instructed it not to attack until his signal. Then he sat back and tried to relax, intent on his final mental preparations, before he called the demon. Across the valley in the magical tower, Ertu crouched in a shadowy corner of Kessel's harem room, keeping its ever-vigilant guard over the evil wizard at play with his mindless girls. A seething fire of hatred burned in Ertu's eyes as it looked upon the foolish Kessel. The wizard had nearly ruined everything with his show of power that afternoon and his refusal to tear down the vacated towers behind him, further draining Crenshinabon's strength. Ertu had been grimly satisfied when Kessel had come back into the Kryshal Tirith and confirmed, through the use of scrying mirrors, that the other two towers had fallen to pieces. Ertu had warned Kessel against raising a third tower, but the wizard, frail of ego, had grown more stubborn with each passing day of the campaign, envisioning the demons or even Crenshinabon's advice as a ploy to undermine his absolute control. And so Ertu was quite receptive, even relieved, when it heard Drizzt's call floating down the valley. At first it denied the possibility of such a summons, but the inflections of its true name being spoken aloud sent involuntary shudders running along the demon's spine. More intrigued than angered at the impertinence of some mortal daring to utter its name, Ertu slipped away from the distracted wizard and moved outside Kryshal Tirith. Then the call came again, cutting through the harmony of the wind's endless song like a white-capped wave on a still pond. Ertu spread its great wings and soared northward over the plain, speeding toward the summoner. Terrified goblins fled from the darkness of the demon's passing shadow, for even in the faint glimmer of a thin moon, the creature of the abyss left a wake of blackness that made the night seem bright in comparison. Drizzt sucked in a tense breath. He sensed the unerring approach of the demon as it veered away from Bremen's run and swept upward over the lower slopes of Kelvin's cairn. Guinevere lifted its head off its paws and growled, also sensing the approach of the evil monster. The cat ducked to the very back of the deep ledge and lay flat and still, awaiting its master's command, confident that its heightened abilities of stealth could protect it even against the highly tuned senses of a demon. Ertu's leathery wings folded up tight as it alighted on the ledge. It immediately pinpointed the exact location of the summoner, and though it had to tuck its broad shoulders to pass through the narrow entrance to the dell, it charged straight in, intent on appeasing its curiosity, and then killing the blasphemous fool that dared utter its name aloud. Drizzt fought to hold his edge of control when the huge demon pushed in, its bulk filling the small area beyond his tiny sanctuary, blocking out the starlight before him. There could be no turning back from his dangerous course. He had no place to run. The demon stopped suddenly in amazement. It had been centuries since Ertu had looked upon a drow, and it certainly never expected to find one on the surface, in the frozen wastelands of the farthest north. Somehow, Drizzt found his voice. "Greetings, Master of Chaos," he said calmly, bowing low. "I am Drizzt O'Erden, of the House of Daermon and Eshesbirnon, ninth family to the throne of Menzo Berenzon. Welcome to my humble camp."
"You're a long way from home, drow," the demon said with obvious suspicion.
"As are thee, great demon of the abyss," Drizzt replied coolly. "And lured to this high corner of the world for similar reasons, unless I miss my guess."
"I know why I am here," answered Ertu. "The business of the drow has ever been outside my understanding or caring."
Drizzt stroked his slender chin and chuckled in feigned confidence. His stomach was tied in knots, and he felt the beginnings of a cold sweat coming on. He chuckled again and fought against the fear. If the demon sensed his unease, his credibility would be greatly diminished. Ah, but this time, for the first time in many years. It seems that the roads of our business have crossed, mighty purveyor of destruction. My people have a curiosity, perhaps even a vested interest, in the wizard that you apparently serve. Ertu squared its shoulders, the first flickers of a dangerous flame evident in its red eyes.
Serve?
It echoed incredulously, the even tone of its voice quivering, as though it bordered on the edge of an uncontrollable rage. Drizzt was quick to qualify his observation. By all appearances, guardian of chaotic intentions, the wizard holds some power over you. Surely you work alongside Akar Kessel.
I serve no human!
Ertu roared, shaking the cave's very foundation with an emphatic stamp of its foot. Drizzt wondered if the fight that he could not hope to win was about to begin. He considered calling out Gwenivar so that they could at least land the first blows. But the demon suddenly calmed again. Convinced that it had half-guessed the reason for the unexpected presence of the drow, Ertu turned a scrutinizing eye on Drizzt.
Serve the wizard?
It laughed.
Akar Kessel is puny, even by the low standards of humans. But you know this drow, and do not dare to deny it. You are here, as I am here, for Kryn Shinoban, and Kessel be damned.
The confused look on Drizzt's face was genuine enough to throw Ertu off balance. The demon still believed that it had guessed correctly, but it couldn't understand why the drow didn't comprehend the name.
Kryn Shinoban,
it explained, sweeping its clawed hand to the south.
An ancient bastion of unspeakable power.
The tower? Drizzt asked. Ertu's uncertainty bubbled up in the form of explosive fury.
Play no games of ignorance with me! The demon bellowed. The drow lords know well the power of Akar Kessel's artifact, or else they would not have come to the surface to seek it out.
Very well. You've guessed at the truth, Drizzt conceded. Yet I had to be certain that the tower on the plain was indeed the ancient artifact that I seek. My masters show little mercy to careless spies. Ertu smiled wickedly as it remembered the unholy torture chambers of Menzo Berenzon. Those years it had spent among the Dark Elves had been enjoyable indeed. Drizzt quickly pressed the conversation in a direction that might reveal some weaknesses of Kessel or his tower. One thing has kept me puzzled, awesome specter of unbridled evil, he began, careful to continue his string of unduplicated compliments. By what right does this wizard possess Kryn Shinoban?
None at all, Ertu said. Wizard, bah! Measured against your own people, he is barely an apprentice. His tongue twitches uneasily when he utters even the simplest of spells. But fate often plays such games. And more to the enjoyment, I say, let Akar Kessel have his brief moment of triumph. Humans do not live a very long time.
Drizzt knew that he was pursuing a dangerous line of questions, but he accepted the risk. Even with a major demon standing barely 10 feet away, Drizzt figured that his chances for survival at this moment were better than those of his friends in Bryn Shander. Still, my masters are concerned that the tower may be harmed in the coming battle with the humans, he bluffed. Ertu took another moment to consider Drizzt. The appearance of the Dark Elves complicated the demon's simple plan to inherit Kryn Shinoban from Kessel. If the mighty drow lords of the huge city of Menzo Berenzon truly had designs upon the relic, the demon knew that they would get it. Certainly Kessel, even with the power of the shard behind him, could not withstand them. The mere presence of this drow changed the demon's perceptions of its relationship with Kryn Shinoban. How Ertu wished that it could simply devour Kessel and flee with the relic before the Dark Elves were too involved. Yet Ertu had never considered the drow as enemies, and the demon had come to despise the bumbling wizard. Perhaps an alliance with the dark elves could prove beneficial to both sides. "Tell me, unequaled champion of darkness," Drizzt pressed, "is Kryn Shinnabon in peril?"
"Bah!" snorted Ertu. "Even the tower that is merely a reflection of Kryn Shinnabon is impervious. It absorbs all attacks directed against its mirrored walls and reflects them back on their source. Only the pulsating crystal of strength, the very heart of Kryshal Tirith, is vulnerable, and that is safely hidden away."
"Inside?"
"Of course."
"But if someone were to get into the tower," Drizzt reasoned, "how well protected would he then find the heart?"
"An impossible task," the demon replied, "unless the simple fishermen of 10 towns have some spirit at their service. Or perhaps a high priest or an archmage to weave spells of unveiling. Surely your masters know that Kryshal Tirith's door is invisible and undetectable to any beings inherent to the present plane the tower rests upon. No creature of this material world, your race included, could find its way in."
"But," Drizzt pressed anxiously, Ertu cut him short.
"Even if someone stumbled into the structure," he growled,
impatient with the relentless stream of impossible suppositions,
"he would have to pass by me. And the limits of Kessel's power within the tower is considerable indeed, for the wizard has become an extension of Kryn Shinnabon itself, a living outlet for the crystal shard's unfathomable strength. The heart lies beyond the very focal point of Kessel's interaction with the tower, and up to the very tip."
The demon stopped, suddenly suspicious of Drizzt's line of questioning. If the lore-wise drow lords were truly intent upon Kryn Shinnabon, why weren't they more aware of its strengths and weaknesses? Ertu understood its mistake then. It examined Drizzt once again, but with a different focus. When it had first encountered the drow, stunned by the mere presence of a dark elf in this region, it had searched for deception in the physical attributes of Drizzt himself to determine if his drow features were an illusion, a clever yet simple shape-alteration trick within the power of even a minor mage. When Ertu was convinced that a true drow and no illusion stood before it, it had accepted the credibility of Drizzt's story as consistent with the characteristics of the dark elves' style. Now, though, the demon scoured the peripheral clues beyond Drizzt's black skin, noting the items he carried and the area he had staked out for their meeting. Nothing that Drizzt had upon his person, not even the weapons sheathed on his hips, emanated the distinct magical properties of the underworld. Perhaps the drow masters had outfitted their spies more appropriately for the surface world, Ertu reasoned. From what it had learned of the dark elves during its many years of service in Menzo Berenzon, this drow's presence was certainly not outrageous. But creatures of chaos survived by trusting no one. Ertu continued his scan for a clue of Drizzt's authenticity. The only item the demon had spotted that reflected on Drizzt's heritage was a thin silver chain strung around his slender neck, a piece of jewelry common among the dark elves for holding a small pouch of wealth. Concentrating upon this, Ertu discovered a second chain, finer than the first, weaving in and out of the other. The demon followed the almost imperceptible crease in Drizzt's jerkin created by the long chain. Unusual, it noted, and possibly revealing. Ertu pointed at the chain, spoke a command word, and raised its outstretched finger into the air. Drizzt tensed when he felt the emblem slipping up from under his leather jerkin. It passed up over the neckline of the garment and dropped to the extent of the chain hanging openly upon his chest. Ertu's evil grin widened along with its squinting eyes.
"Unusual choice for a drow,"
it hissed sarcastically.
I would have expected the symbol of Loth, demon queen of your people. She would not be pleased.
From nowhere, it seemed, a many-thonged whip appeared in one of the demon's hands and a jagged, cruelly notched blade in the other. At first, Driz's mind whirled down 100 avenues, exploring the most feasible lies he could spin to get him out of this fix. But then he shook his head resolutely and pushed the lies away. He would not dishonor his deity. At the end of the silver chain hung a gift from Regis, a carving the halfling had done from the bone of one of the few knuckleheads he had ever hooked. Drizzt had been deeply touched when Regis presented it to him, and he considered it the halfling's finest work. It twirled around on the long chain, its gentle grades and shading giving it the depth of a true work of art. It was a white unicorn head, the symbol of the goddess, Mieliki.
"Who are you, drow?" Ertu demanded.
The demon had already decided that it would have to kill Drizzt, but it was intrigued by such an unusual meeting. A dark elf that followed the Lady of the Forest, and a surface dweller as well. Ertu had known many drow over the centuries, but had never even heard of one that had abandoned the drow's wicked ways. Cold-hearted killers, one and all, that had taught even the great demon of chaos a trick or two concerning the methods of excruciating torture.
"I am Drizzt O'Erden. That much is true," Drizzt replied evenly. "He who forsook the house of Daemon Eneshezbernon."
All fear had flown from Drizzt when he accepted, beyond any hope, that he would have to battle the demon. Now he assumed the calm readiness of a seasoned fighter, prepared to seize any advantage that might fall his way.
"A ranger, humbly serving Gueron Winstrom, hero of the goddess Mieliki."
He bowed low in accordance with a proper introduction. As he straightened, he drew his scimitars.
"I must defeat you, scar of vileness," he declared, "and send you back to the swirling clouds of the bottomless abyss. There is no place in the sunlit world for one of your kind." "You are confused, elf," the demon said. "You have lost the way of your heritage, and now you dare to presume that you might defeat me?"
Flames sprang to life from the stone wall all around Ertu.
"I would have killed you mercifully with one clean stroke out of respect for your kin, but your pride distresses me. I shall teach you to desire death. Come, feel the sting of my fire."
Drizzt was already nearly overwhelmed by the heat of Ertu's demon fire, and the brightness of the flames stung his sensitive eyes, so that the bulk of the demon seemed only the dulled blur of a shadow. He saw the darkness extend to the demon's right, and knew that Ertu had raised its terrible sword. He moved to defend, but suddenly the demon lurched to the side and roared in surprise and outrage. Guinevere had latched firmly onto its upraised arm. The huge demon held the panther at arm's length, trying to pin the cat between its forearm and the rock wall to keep the tearing claws and teeth away from a vital area. Guinevere gnawed and raked the massive arm, tearing demon flesh and muscle. Ertu winced away the vicious attack and determined to deal with the cat later. The demon's main concern remained the drow, for it respected the potential power of any of the dark elves. Ertu had seen too many foes fall beneath one of the dark elves' countless tricks. The many-thonged whip lashed out at Drizzt's legs, too quickly for the drow, still reeling from the sudden burst of brightness of the flames, to deflect the blow or dodge aside. Ertu jerked the handle as the thongs tangled about the slender legs and ankles, the demon's great strength easily dropping Drizzt to his back. Drizzt felt the stinging pain all through his legs, and he heard the rush of air pressed out of his lungs when he landed on the hard stone. He knew that he must react without delay, but the glare of the fire and Ertu's sudden strike had left him disoriented. He felt himself being dragged along the stone, felt the intensity of the heat increasing. He managed to lift his head just in time to view his tangled feet entering the demon fire.
"And so I die," he stated flatly.
But his legs did not burn. Drooling to hear the agonized screams of its helpless victim, Air-2 gave a stronger tug on the whip and pulled Drizzt completely into the flames. Though he was totally immolated, the drow barely felt warmed by the fire. And then, with a final hiss of protest, the hot flames suddenly died away. Neither of the opponents understood what had happened, both assuming that the other had been responsible. Air-2 struck quickly again, bringing a heavy foot down upon Drizzt's chest. It began grinding him into the stone. The drow flailed out in desperation with one weapon, but it had no effect on the otherworldly monster. Then Drizzt swung his other scimitar, the blade he had taken from the dragon's hoard. Hissing like water on fire, it entered Air-2's knee joint. The hilt of the weapon heated up when the blade tore into the demon's flesh, nearly burning Drizzt's hand. Then it grew icy cold, as though dousing Air-2's hot life force with a cold strength of its own. Drizzt understood then what had extinguished the fires. The demon gaped in blank horror, then screamed in agony. Never had it felt such a sting. It leaped back and tossed about wildly, trying to escape the weapon's terrible bite, dragging Drizzt, who could not let go of the hilt. Guinevere was thrown in the violence of the demon's rage, flying from the monster's arm to crash heavily into a wall. Drizzt eyed the wound incredulously as the demon backed away. Steam poured from the hole in Air-2's knee, and the edges of the cut were iced over. Drizzt, too, had been weakened by the strike. In its struggle with the mighty demon, the scimitar had drawn upon its wielder's life force, pulling Drizzt into the battle with a fiery monster. Now the drow felt as though he hadn't even the strength left to stand, but he found himself lunging forward, blade fully extended before him, as if pulled by the scimitar's hunger. The cubby entrance was too narrow. Air-2 could neither dodge nor spring away. The scimitar found the demon's belly. The explosive surge as the blade touched the core of Air-2's life force drained away Drizzt's strength, tossing him backward. He cracked against the stone wall and crumpled, but managed to keep himself alert enough to witness the titanic struggle still raging. Air-2 got out onto the ledge. The demon was staggering now, trying to spread its wings, but they drooped weakly. The scimitar glowed white with powder as it continued its assault. The demon could not bear to grasp it and tear it free, though the embedded blade, its magic quenching the fires it had been wrought to destroy, was surely winning the conflict. Air-2 knew that it had been careless, overconfident in its ability to destroy any mortal in single combat. The demon hadn't considered the possibility of such a wicked blade. It had never even heard of a weapon with such a sting. Steam poured from Air-2's exposed entrails and enveloped the combatants.
"And so you have banished me, treacherous drow!" it spat.
Dazed, Drizzt watched in amazement as the white glow intensified and the black shadow diminished.
100 years, drow! Air-2 howled. Not such a long time for the likes of you or me!
The vapor thickened as the shadow seemed to melt away.
A century, Drizzt O'Erden!
Came Air-2's fading cry from somewhere far away.
Look over your shoulder, then! Air-2 shall not be far behind.
The vapor wafted up into the air and was gone. The last sound Drizzt heard was the clang of the metal scimitar falling to the stone ledge. 26. Rites of Victory. Wulfgar leaned back in his chair at the head of the main table in the hastily constructed mead hall, his foot tapping nervously at the long delays necessitated by the demands of proper tradition. He felt that his people should already be on the move, but it was the restoration of the traditional ceremonies and celebrations that had immediately separated and placed him above the tyrant Hiefstag in the eyes of the skeptical and ever-suspicious barbarians. Wulfgar, after all, had walked into their midst after a 5-year absence and challenged their long-standing king. One day later he had won the crown, and the day after that he had been coronated King Wulfgar of the Tribe of the Elk. And he was determined that his reign, short though he intended it to be, would not be marked by the threats and bullying tactics of his predecessors. He would ask the warriors of the assembled tribes to follow him into battle, not command them. For he knew that a barbarian warrior was a man driven almost exclusively by fierce pride. stripped of their dignity, as Hiefstag had done by refusing to honor the sovereignty of each individual king, the tribesmen were no better in battle than ordinary men. Wulfgar knew that they would need to regain their proud edge if they were to have any chance at all against the wizard's overwhelming numbers. Thus, Hengorot, the mead hall, had been raised, and the challenge of the song initiated for the first time in nearly 5 years. It was a short, happy time of good-natured competition between tribes who had been suffocated under Hiefstag's unrelenting domination. The decision to raise the Deerskin Hall had been difficult for Wulfgar. Assuming that he still had time before Kessel's army struck, he had weighed the benefits of regaining tradition against the pressing need of haste. He only hoped that in the frenzy of pre-battle preparations, Kessel would overlook the absence of the barbarian king, Hiefstag. If the wizard was at all sharp, it wasn't likely. Now he waited quietly and patiently, watching the fires return to the eyes of the tribesmen.
"Like old times?"
Revyak asked, sitting next to him.
"Good times," Wulfgar responded.
Satisfied, Revyak leaned back against the tent's deerskin wall, granting the new chief the solitude he obviously desired. And Wulfgar resumed his wait, seeking the best moment to unveil his proposition. At the far end of the hall, an axe-throwing competition was beginning. Similar to the tactics Hiefstag and Beorg had used to seal a pact between the tribes at the last Hengorot, the challenge was to hurl an axe from as great a distance as possible and sink it deeply enough into a keg of mead to open a hole. The number of mugs that could be filled from the effort within a specified count determined the success of the throw. Wulfgar saw his chance. He leaped from his stool and demanded, by rights of being the host, the first throw. The man who had been selected to judge the challenge acknowledged Wulfgar's right and invited him to come down to the first selected distance.
"From here,"
Wulfgar said, hoisting Aegis Fang to his shoulder. Murmurs of disbelief and excitement arose from all corners of the hall. The use of a warhammer in such a challenge was unprecedented, but none complained or cited rules. Every man who had heard the tales, but not witnessed firsthand the splitting of Hiefstag's great axe, was anxious to see the weapon in action. A keg of mead was placed upon a stool at the back end of the hall.
"Another behind it," Wulfgar demanded, "and another behind that."
His concentration narrowed on the task at hand, and he didn't take the time to sort out the whispers he heard all around him. The kegs were readied, and the crowd backed out of the young king's line of sight. Wulfgar grasped Aegis Fang tightly in his hands and sucked in a great breath, holding it in to keep himself steady. The unbelieving onlookers watched in amazement as the new king exploded into movement, hurling the mighty hammer with a fluid motion and strength unmatched among their ranks. Aegis Fang tumbled, head over handle, the length of the long hall, blasting through the first keg and then the second and beyond, taking not only the three targets and their stools, but continuing on to tear a hole in the back of the mead hall. The closest warriors hurried to the opening to watch the remainder of its flight, but the hammer had disappeared into the night. They started out to retrieve it, but Wulfgar stopped them. He sprang onto the table, lifting his arms before him.
"Hear me, warriors of the northern plains!" he cried.
Their mouths already agape at the unprecedented feat, some fell to their knees when Aegis Fang suddenly reappeared in the young king's hands.
"I am Wulfgar, son of Beornagar and king of the tribe of the Elk. Yet I speak to you now not as your king, but as a kindred warrior, horrified at the dishonor Hiefstag tried to place upon us all."
Spurred on by the knowledge that he had gained their attention and respect, and by the confirmation that his assumptions of their true desires had not been in error, Wulfgar seized the moment. These people had cried out for deliverance from the tyrannical reign of the One-Eyed King and beaten almost to extinction in their last campaign, and now about to fight beside goblins and giants, they longed for a hero to gain them back their lost pride.
"I am the Dragon Slayer," he continued, "and by right of victory, I possess the treasures of Isengdeath."
Again, the private conversations interrupted him, for the now unguarded treasure had become a subject for debate. Wulfgar let them continue their gossip for a long moment to heighten their interest in the dragon's gold. When they finally quieted, he went on. The tribes of the tundra do not fight in a common cause with goblins and giants, he decreed to rousing shouts of approval. We fight against them! The crowd suddenly hushed. A guard rushed into the tent, but did not dare interrupt the new king. I leave with the dawn for 10 towns, Wulfgar stated. I shall battle against the wizard Kessel and the foul horde he has pulled from the holes of the spine of the world. The crowd did not respond. They accepted the notion of battle against Kessel eagerly, but the thought of returning to 10 towns to help the people who had nearly destroyed them 5 years before had never occurred to them. But the guard now intervened. I fear that your quest shall be in vain, young king, he said. Wulfgar turned a distressed eye upon the man, guessing the news he bore. The smoke clouds from great fires are even now rising above the southern plain. Wulfgar considered the distressing news. He had thought that he would have more time. Then I shall leave tonight, he roared at the stunned assembly. Come with me, my friends, my fellow warriors of the north. I shall show you the path to the lost glories of our past. The crowd seemed torn and uncertain. Wulfgar played his final card. To any man who will go with me, or to his surviving kin if he should fall, I offer an equal share of the dragon's treasure. He had swept in like a mighty squall off the sea of moving ice. He had captured the imagination and heart of every barbarian warrior and had promised them a return to the wealth and glory of their brightest days. That very night, Wulfgar's mercenary army charged out of their encampment and thundered across the open plain. Not a single man remained behind.
27. The Clock of Doom. Bremen was torched at dawn. The people of the small, unwalled village had known better than to stand and fight when the wave of monsters rolled across the Shaingarn River. They put up token resistance at the ford, firing a few bursts of arrows at the lead goblins just to slow the ranks long enough for the heaviest and slowest ships to clear the harbor and reach the safety of Mer Dualden. The archers then fled back to the docks and followed their fellow townsmen. When the goblins finally entered the city, they found it completely deserted. They watched angrily as the sailing ships moved back toward the east to join the flotilla of Targos and Tourmaline. Bremen was too far out of the way to be of any use to Akkar Kessel, so unlike the city of Tourmaline, which had been converted into a camp, this city was burned to the ground. The people on the lake, the newest in the long line of homeless victims of Kessel's wanton destruction, watched helplessly as their homes fell in smoldering splinters. From the wall of Bryn Shander, Cassius and Regis watched too.
He has made yet another mistake, Cassius told the halfling.
How so?
Kessel has backed the people of Targos and Tourmaline, Kaer Koenig and Kaer Dinneval, and now Bremen into a corner, Cassius explained. They have nowhere to go now. Their only hope lies in victory.
Not much of a hope, Regis remarked. You have seen what the tower can do, and even without it, Kessel's army could destroy us all. As he said, he holds every advantage.
Perhaps, Cassius conceded. The wizard believes that he is invincible, that much is certain. And that is his mistake, my friend. The meekest of animals will fight bravely when it is backed against a wall, for it has nothing to lose. A poor man is more deadly than a rich man because he puts less value on his own life. And a man stranded homeless on the frozen steppes, with the first winds of winter already beginning to blow, is a formidable enemy indeed. Fear not, little friend, Cassius continued. At our council this morning, we shall find a way to exploit the wizard's weaknesses.
Regis nodded. Unable to dispute the spokesman's simple logic and unwilling to refute his optimism. Still, as he scanned the deep ranks of goblins and orcs that surrounded the city, the halfling held out little hope. He looked northward, where the dust had finally settled on the Dwarven Valley. Brunner's climb was no more, having toppled with the rest of the cliff face when the dwarves closed up their caverns.
"Open a door for me, Brunner," Regis whispered absently. "Please let me in."
Coincidentally, Brunner and his clan were, at that very moment, discussing the feasibility of opening a door in their tunnels, but not to let anyone in. Soon after their smashing success against the ogres and goblins on the ledges outside their mines, the fighting Longbeards had realized they could not sit idly by while orcs and goblins and even worse monsters destroyed the world around them. They were eager to take a second shot at Kessel. In their underground womb, they had no idea if Bryn Shander was still standing or if Kessel's army had already rolled over all of Ten Towns, but they could hear the sounds of an encampment above the southernmost sections of their huge complex. Brunner was the one who had proposed the idea of a second battle, mainly because of his own anger at the imminent loss of his closest non-dwarven friends. Shortly after the goblins that had escaped the tunnel collapse had been cut down, the leader of the clan from Mithril Hall gathered the whole of his people around him.
"Send someone to the farthest ends of the tunnels," he instructed. "Find out where the dogs'll do their sleeping."
That night, the sounds of the marching monsters became obvious far in the south, under the fields surrounding Bryn Shander. The industrious dwarves immediately set about reconditioning the little-used tunnels that ran in that direction. And when they had gotten under the army, they dug 10 separate upward shafts, stopping just shy of the surface. A special gleam had returned to their eyes, the sparkle of a dwarf who knows that he's about to chop off a few goblin heads. Brunner's devious plan had endless potential for revenge with minimal risk. With 5 minutes' notice, they could complete their new exits. Less than a minute beyond that, their entire force would be up in the middle of Kessel's sleeping army. The meeting that Cassius had labeled a council was truly more of a forum, where the spokesman from Bryn Shander could unveil his first retaliatory strategies. Yet none of the gathered leaders, even Glenn Sather, the only other spokesman in attendance, protested in the least. Cassius had studied every aspect of the entrenched goblin army and the wizard with meticulous attention to detail. The spokesman had outlined a layout of the entire force, detailing the most potentially explosive rivalries among the goblin and orc ranks, and his best estimates about the length of time it would take for the inner fighting to sufficiently weaken the army. Everyone in attendance was agreed, though, that the cornerstone holding the siege together was Kryshal Tirith. The awesome power of the crystalline structure would cow even the most disruptive orcs into unquestioning obedience. Yet the limits of that power, as Cassius saw it, were the real issue. "Why was Kessel so insistent on an immediate surrender?" the spokesman reasoned. "He could let us sit under the stress of a siege for a few days to soften our resistance." The others agreed with the logic of Cassius's line of thinking, but had no answers for him. "Perhaps Kessel does not command as strong a hold over his charges as we believe," Cassius himself proposed. "Might it be that the wizard fears his army will disintegrate around him if stalled for any length of time?" "It might," replied Glenn Sather of Easthaven. "Or maybe Akar Kessel simply perceives the strength of his advantage and knows that we have no choice but to comply. Do you perhaps confuse confidence with concern?" Cassius paused for a moment to reflect on the question. "A point well taken," he said at length, "yet immaterial to our plans." Glenn Sather and several others cocked a curious eye at the spokesman. "We assume the latter," Cassius explained. "If the wizard is truly in absolute control of the gathered army, then anything we might attempt shall prove futile in any case. Therefore, we must act on the assumption that Kessel's impatience reveals well-founded concern." "I do not perceive the wizard as an exceptional strategist. He has embarked on a path of destruction that he assumed would cow us into submission, yet which, in reality, has actually strengthened the resolve of many of our people to fight to the last.
long-standing rivalries between several of the towns, bitterness that a wise leader of an invading force would surely have twisted into an excellent advantage, have been mended by Kessel's blatant disregard of finesse and his displays of outrageous brutality.
Cassius knew by the attentive looks he was receiving that he was gaining support from every corner. He was trying to accomplish two things in this meeting: to convince the others to go along with the gamble he was about to unveil, and to lift their outlook and give them back some shred of hope.
"Our people are out there," he said, sweeping his arm in a wide arc. "On Mare de Walden and Lac Dinashir, the fleets have gathered, awaiting some sign from Bryn Shander that we shall support them. The people of Goodmead and Dugan's Hole do likewise on the southern lake, fully armed, and knowing full well that in this struggle there is nothing left at all for any survivors if we are not victorious."
He leaned forward over the table, alternately catching and holding the gaze of each man seated before him, and concluded grimly,
"No homes? No hope for our wives? No hope for our children? Nowhere left to run?"
Cassius continued to rally the others around him, and was soon backed by Glensather, who had guessed at the spokesman's goal of increasing morale and recognized the value of it. Cassius searched for the most opportune moment. When the majority of the assembled leaders had replaced their frowns of despair with the determined grimace of survival, he put forth his daring plan.
"Kessel has demanded an emissary," he said, "and so we must deliver one."
"You or I would seem the most obvious choice," Glensather intervened. "Which shall it be?"
A wry smile spread across Cassius's face.
"Neither," he replied. "One of us would be the obvious choice if we intended to go along with Kessel's demands. But we have one other option."
He turned his gaze squarely upon Regis. The halfling squirmed uncomfortably, half guessing what the spokesman had in mind.
"There is one among us who has attained an almost legendary reputation for his considerable abilities of persuasion. Perhaps his charismatic appeal shall win us some valuable time in our dealings with the wizard."
Regis felt ill. He had often wondered when the ruby pendant was going to get him into trouble too deep to climb out of. Several other people eyed Regis now, apparently intrigued by the potential of Cassius's suggestion. The stories of the halfling's charm and persuasive ability, and the accusation that Kemp had made at the council a few 10 days earlier, had been told and retold 1,000 times in every one of the towns, each storyteller typically enhancing and exaggerating the tales to increase his own importance. Though Regis hadn't been thrilled with losing the power of his secret, people seldom looked him straight in the eye anymore, he had come to enjoy a certain degree of fame. He hadn't considered the possible negative side effects of having so many people looking up to him.
"Let the halfling, the former spokesman from Lonelywood, represent us in Akkar Kessel's court,"
Cassius declared to the nearly unanimous approval of the assembly.
"Perhaps our small friend will be able to convince the wizard of the error of his evil ways."
"You are mistaken," Regis protested. "They are only rumors."
"Humility," Cassius interrupted, "is a fine trait, good halfling. And all gathered here appreciate the sincerity of your self-doubts, and appreciate even more so your willingness to pit your talents against Kessel in the face of those self-doubts."
Regis closed his eyes and did not reply, knowing that the motion would surely pass whether he approved or not. It did, without a single dissenting vote. The cornered people were quite willing to grab at any sliver of hope they could find. Cassius moved quickly to wrap up the council, for he believed that all other matters, problems of overcrowding and food hoarding, were of little importance at a time like this. If Regis failed, every other inconvenience would become immaterial. Regis remained silent. He had only attended the council to lend support to his spokesman friends. When he took his seat at the table, he had no intentions of even actively participating in the discussions, let alone becoming the focal point of the defense plan. And so the meeting adjourned. Cassius and Glensather exchanged knowing winks of success, for everyone left the room feeling a bit more optimistic. Cassius held Regis back when he moved to leave with the others. The spokesman from Bryn Shander shut the door behind the last of them,
desiring a private briefing with the principal character of the first stages of his plan.
"You could have spoken to me about all of this first,"
Regis grumbled at the spokesman's back as soon as the door was closed.
"It seems only right that I should have been given the opportunity to make a decision in this matter."
Cassius wore a grim visage as he turned to face the halfling. "What choice do any of us have?" he asked. "At least this way, we have given them all some hope."
"You overestimate me,"
Regis protested. "Perhaps you underestimate yourself," Cassius said. Though the halfling realized that Cassius would not back away from the plan he had set in motion, the spokesman's confidence relayed an altruistic spirit to Regis that was genuinely comforting.
"Let us pray, for both our sakes, that the latter is the truth," Cassius continued, moving to his seat at the table. "But I truly believe this to be the case. I have faith in you, even if you do not. I remember well what you did to Spokesman Kemp at the council 5 years ago, though it took his own declaration that he had been tricked to make me realize the truth of the situation. A masterful job of persuasion, Regis of Lonelywood, and more so because it held its secret for so long."
Regis blushed and conceded the point.
"And if you can deal with the stubborn likes of Kemp of Targos, you should find Akar Kessel easy prey."
"I agree with your perceptions of Kessel as something less than a man of inner strength," said Regis. "But wizards have a way of uncovering wizard-like tricks. And you forget the demon. I would not even attempt to deceive one of its kind."
"Let us hope that you shall not have to deal with that one," Cassius agreed with a visible shudder.
"Yet I feel that you must go to the tower and try to dissuade the wizard. If we cannot somehow hold the gathered army at bay until its own inner turmoil becomes our ally, then we are surely doomed. Believe me, as I am your friend, that I would not ask you to journey into such peril if I saw any other possible path."
A pained look of helpless empathy had clearly worn through the spokesman's earlier facade of rousing optimism. His concern touched Regis, as would a starving man crying out for food. Even beyond his feelings for the overly pressured spokesman, Regis was forced to admit the logic of the plan and the absence of other avenues to explore. Kessel hadn't given them much time to regroup after the initial attack. In the raising of Targos, the wizard had demonstrated his ability to likewise destroy Bryn Shander, and the halfling had little doubt that Kessel would carry out his vile threat. So, Regis came to accept his role as their only option. The halfling wasn't easily spurred to action, but when he made up his mind to do something, he usually tried to do it properly.
"First of all," he began, "I must tell you in the strictest of confidence that I do indeed have magical aid."
A glimmer of hope returned to Cassius's eyes. He leaned forward, anxious to hear more, but Regis calmed him with an outstretched palm.
"You must understand, however," the halfling explained, "that I do not, as some tales claim, have the power to pervert what is in a person's heart. I could not convince Kessel to abandon his evil path any more than I could convince Spokesman Kemp to make peace with Tourmaline."
He rose from his cushioned chair and paced around the table, his hands clasped behind his back. Cassius watched him in uncertain anticipation, unable to figure out exactly what he was leading up to with his admission and then disclaimer of power.
"Sometimes, though, I do have a way of making someone view his surroundings from a different perspective,"
Regis admitted.
"Like the incident you have referred to, when I convinced Kemp that embarking upon a certain preferable course of action would actually help him to achieve his own aspirations. So tell me again, Cassius, all that you have learned about the wizard and his army. Let us see if we might discover a way to make Kessel doubt the very things that he has come to rely upon."
The halfling's eloquence stunned the spokesman. Even though he hadn't looked Regis in the eye, he could see the promise of truth in the tales he had always presumed to be exaggerated. "We know from the newsbearer that Kemp has taken command of the remaining forces of the four towns on Mare de Walden," Cassius explained.
"Likewise, Jensen Brent and Chairmont are poised upon Lac Dinashir,
and combined with the fleets of Redwaters, they should prove a powerful force indeed. Kemp has already vowed revenge, and I doubt if any of the other refugees entertain thoughts of surrender or fleeing.
Where could they go?
Regis muttered. He looked pitifully at Cassius, who had no words of comfort. Cassius had put on a show of confidence and hope for the others at the council and for the people in the town, but he could not look at Regis now and make hollow promises. Glenn Sather suddenly burst back into the room.
The wizard is back on the field, he cried. He has demanded our emissary. The lights on the tower have started again.
The three rushed from the building, Cassius reiterating as much of the pertinent information as he could. Regis silenced him.
I am prepared, he assured Cassius. I don't know if this outrageous scheme of yours has any chance of working, but you have my vow that I'll work hard to carry out the deception.
Then they were at the gate. It must work, Cassius said, clapping Regis on the shoulder. We have no other hope. He started to turn away, but Regis had one final question that he needed answered.
If I find that Kessel is beyond my power, he asked grimly, what am I to do if the deception fails?
Cassius looked around at the thousands of women and children huddled against the chill wind in the city's common grounds. If it fails, he began slowly, if Kessel cannot be dissuaded from using the power of the tower against Bryn Shander, he paused again, if only to delay having to hear himself utter the words.
You are then under my personal orders to surrender the city.
Cassius turned away and headed for the parapets to witness the critical confrontation. Regis didn't hesitate any longer, for he knew that any pause at this frightening juncture would probably cause him to change his mind and run to find a hiding place in some dark hole in the city. Before he even had the chance to reconsider, he was through the gate and boldly marching down the hill toward the waiting specter of Akar Kessel. Kessel had again appeared between two mirrors borne by trolls, standing with arms crossed and one foot tapping impatiently. The evil scowl on his face gave Regis the distinct impression that the wizard, in a fit of uncontrollable rage, would strike him dead before he even reached the bottom of the hill. Yet the halfling had to keep his eyes focused on Kessel to even continue his approach. The wretched trolls disgusted and revulsed him beyond anything he had ever encountered, and it took all of his willpower to move anywhere near them. Even from the gate, he could smell the foul odor of their rotting stench. But somehow he made it to the mirrors and stood facing the evil wizard. Kessel studied the emissary for quite a while. He certainly hadn't